Hello and welcome to Epoch number 42. And this time we'll be finishing off part four of our deep dive into the origins of World War One. And once again, I'm joined by the magnificent, the peerless Apostolic Majesty. How are you, sir?
You do me great honour, but I'll throw away your accolades there. I don't believe I'm peerless by any means, but thank you regardless.
I hope you don't think I've been sarky. Certainly not that. But okay, yeah. So let's jump in. Last time we finished off around, well, we were talking about things in 1912, 1913 sort of time. Mm. So getting right up close to the big year. So I thought I'll, as per, throw it over to you and let you decide how best to pick up the narrative.
Yeah, so obviously this conversation is going to focus around the July crisis and the immediate impetus for war. But before we go into that, a topic we haven't really covered, we've now gone over most of the diplomatic aspects before 1914, but we haven't really understood the military implications of where the nations find themselves as of 1914. So to quickly summarize, the Russians and the French are in a hard alliance. So are the Austrians and the Germans. And the British are still wavering, but nominally they have some form of entente association with France and to a lesser extent with Russia. So with that basic understanding, it's interesting to see the development of German war planning in particular, because there are three great sort of military thinkers when talking about this imperial period in Germany. One is, of course, Helmut von Moltke the Elder, who was responsible for the great sort of genius campaigns during the German Wars of Unification. You have von Schlieffen, who is the German head of staff in the interim. And then you have the nephew of von Moltke, the elder, von Moltke, the younger, who is the chief of staff at the outset of the Great War. What is remarkable is that despite, you know, what you consider the French defeat in the Franco-Prussian War, Moltke the Elder begins to take a very skeptical approach to war with France. And a lot of German planning is actually rather focusing on the defensive angle. And when we come to Schlieffen, so Schlieffen is working between the late 19th century up until 1906, when he retires. He's trying to, again, judge what will be the best strategy of a war between France and Russia, who are now firmly allied at this point. And much of the war planning is focused on avoiding something called Ummattungskrieg, or a war of exhaustion, something which would entail Germany fighting off against powers which have more men and more resources, as is the case in both world wars. So therefore, how is Germany going to deal with a war against France and Germany? Is it going to take a defensive strategy, or is it going to take an offensive strategy? Well, the French had from the end of the Franco-Prussian War been building up a series of fortresses west of Alsace-Lorraine. The main fortresses for our conversation are Verdun, Toul, Epinal, and Belfort. And as a result of this, an actual German invasion into France through Lorraine was, again, looking very implausible because of the strength of French fortifications in that region. So one possible strategy is to allow the French to attack Germany. And again, plausibly, this would give the Germans, you know, wiggle room when it came to not getting other powers involved, because the French would be the aggressor. However, because the Russians were allied, it also meant that Germany would be attacked on two fronts simultaneously, perhaps overwhelmed by the combined forces of France and Germany. And therefore, I mean, this was when Schlieffen was writing this, the situation for Germany was less dire than it was in 1914. This was in 1905, 1906, around a time where Russia had just been defeated by the Japanese. So already, even though the Russians were comparatively weaker than they would be later on, Schlieffen adopts this idea of Bewegungskrieg, or war of movement. The idea being that Germany has to defeat France quickly and then move on to engage in a longer conflict towards Russia, to deal with this idea of encirclement, namely because the idea of a defensive war was impossible. And important for our conversation, because of the French fortresses that I've mentioned, the only possible way of actually engaging the French in a decisive battle to win the conflict quickly would be to invade through Belgium, which of course had been guaranteed its neutrality since 1939 by France, Britain, and of course, Germany. So that is the basic setup. But how do we get from that strategic situation in 1906 to 1914? Well, the situation for Germany is becoming more dire because after the defeat of their defeat in the Japanese War, the French are giving them vast amounts of loans, the Russians, in terms of building up tracks. You know, we're talking thousands of miles of tracks that would link Moscow and various checkpoints to the Western Front, but interestingly enough, also to Afghanistan and Central Asia as well. So it was directed against Britain and France, even after the Germany and Britain after the formation of the Entente. And what this essentially meant is that the Germans were now facing a Russian army, which had better logistics. It was larger. The Russians were undergoing various military reforms to make mobilization quicker. And as a result of this, much of the Schlieffen Plan, the idea of a Bewegungskrieg, was built upon the assumption that the Russians would be able to mobilize very slowly. However, as we come towards 1914, this is quickly unraveling as a strategy, and it's becoming far more likely that the Russians will be able to act very quickly in the event of war. And by 1912, the Russians and the French are actually combining their military plans together in the event of a two-pronged attack. The Russian plan was a plan called Plan 19. Obviously, the numbering of the plans obviously indicate that this went through a series of revisions. Mm-hmm. And this was organized by a general, Yuri Danilov. And essentially, the Russians were thinking, what should we focus on? Should we attack Germany or should we defend against Austria-Hungary? Danilov personally favored the idea of an immediate invasion against Germany. If you look at a map of Germany, you have Silesia, you have Posen, you have Danzig, and then you have a long sort of stretch of territory, which is East Prussia, which Russia surrounds on three fronts. So if you go up the Vistula, if you take that bit of territory, you can disconnect a significant part of Germany from the rest of Germany. And this would also correspond with a French attack. The French attack was devised by the Minister of War, Joseph Joffre, and it was called Plan 17, which meant that the French would swiftly invade around the Lorraine region in concert with a possible Russian invasion at the same time. However, if such an invasion didn't go well, the French were equally preparing for an attack into Germany through Alsace-Lorraine, but also to meet Germany in Belgium. They were anticipating an attack through Belgium at the same time, believing that Germany could very easily violate German neutrality. Interestingly enough, the French high command from 1912 onwards got rid of people advocating a more defensive strategy, such as Victor Constant Michel, and replaced him with a war hawk, Joseph Joffre. But of course, all of this, the important thing in terms of understanding the French position, all of this was built on the idea that Germany had to attack first. Because if the French attack first through Belgium, then the French will be the ones accused of violating Belgian neutrality, not the Germans. So if the Germans didn't attack through Belgium, the French couldn't then attack Germany through Belgium. They had to go through Alsace and Lorraine, and they had to find a way of getting around the major military fortification at Metz. And in terms of looking at Russia and looking at this grand strategy of building up their army, from the point of view of German intelligence and the German chief of staff, the Russian army would be fully completed in this new campaign of reconstruction by 1917. And the railway tracks financed by the French would be on track by 1922. So this was the strategic situation in Europe before the July crisis.
I see. So Schlieffen himself was entirely out of the picture, completely retired, right, by 1914.
Yes.
So I wonder to what extent the Schlieffen Plan was common knowledge, but was it known about in any detail by, say, the French high command or the British intelligence or whatever?
Well, yes, I think it's fair to understand, less the British involved in land strategies, but definitely the French. Mm-hmm. By plans 16 through 17, we're very much emphasizing this idea that they were expecting the Germans to come through Belgium.
Right.
It was the most likely course of attack. And again, if they weren't going to attack through Belgium, then the French would attack Germany through Lorraine. So the idea of the Germans actually coming through and attacking the main fortresses at Verdun, Tours, Epinal and Belfort was considered, again, a plan that would essentially force Germany into this position of Ermattungskrieg, this idea of war of exhaustion, because if Germany attacked those fortresses, it would be delayed for months, years. And of course, as you know, probably in 1915, Falkenhayn decided to attack Verdun, and the one fortress was never taken, even though the strategy behind it is a bit more complicated than that. But again, that's just to illustrate how foolhardy it is to focus on those fortresses as a serious point of strategy when you're also dealing with a two-front war against the Russians, who have far more resources and far more men than you can possibly field in a campaign.
Just like the Maginot Line, in a way, there's, I suppose, like a line of faults will only get you so far, usually. I'm actually happens to be I'm fascinated by the Battle of Verdun. It's probably one of the World War I battles I'm sort of most interested in, and how they've had a sort of loads of satellite forts all around. It wasn't just one thing. That sort of, I think, famously Fort Douaumont fell without a shot, didn't it? That was sort of one of the famous ones around Verdun. But just want to ask you about another question, just real quick, about the Schlieffen Plan, and that it, I suppose, it always gets said, sort of the armchair historian level of things, is that it was just simply out of date by 1914, or long before even 1914, and that, you know, in hindsight, it's easy to say, but I really should have tweaked things or come up with a different plan by that point. Is that fair, or is that just hindsight? How do you feel about that? Is that an unfair criticism of it, or is it totally fair enough?
Well, interestingly enough, the narrative I'm sort of accustomed with is actually the opposite of that, is that von Moltke was accused of revising the plan, which was already perfect to begin with.
I have heard that angle. Yeah, it would have been fine if you hadn't have messed with it.
Von Moltke made some minor additions to it, such as the original plan involved going through the Limburg province in around Maastricht in the Netherlands. And the new plan advocated by von Moltke was focusing almost principally on the fortress of Liège in eastern Belgium and bypassing any sort of conflict with the Netherlands at all. There were minor aspects to it, but I think that understanding, again, so much of German war planning, because the Germans are best when it comes to their war planning, the prestige of the chief of staff of the German sort of staff units were legendary at this point. But the assumption here is that all these plans essentially were focused on this principal idea of movement warfare, defeating the French and moving on to defeat the Russians. How individual commanders, you know, met with individual forces, or what the implications of those plans were always intended to be up for revision. And Schlieffen understood this, and, you know, Moltke, again, follow through in this plan. And again, I think, with hindsight, I don't really see that there was that much wrong with Moltke's central, you know, thesis. Of anything, I believe the Bewegungskrieg wasn't fast enough, and that the threat from Russia, which von Moltke was going about incessantly throughout the July crisis, was actually understated in his own mind in terms of the ability of the Russians to mobilize. Because in the event, the Russians were able to commence their attack on East Prussia far more quickly than anyone was able to realize. But of course, as we all know, the attack was premature, and it resulted in the disastrous defeat for the Russians at Tannenberg.
Is it correct that von Moltke the Elder was thought of as, he was put on some sort of pedestal,
yes,
in a way that he was, his mind, his tactical strategic sense was beyond reproach. And so whatever he'd sort of said was, you know, you couldn't really question it, or not too much anyway.
Well, he was the hero of German unification, right? Exactly. And a lot of, you know, historians trying to psychoanalyze von Moltke pit him in his mind as to try and emulate his famous uncle.
Do you think that's fair, or is that?
No, I think that's fair. And I think it was one of the contributing reasons as to why von Moltke resigned from his commission so early into the First World War, because he realized that the fundamental planning had resulted in a less than favorable strategy for Germany, and that the idea of a Bewegungskrieg had failed when Germany was forced into a position of trench warfare. So no, I think that was fair. And he was then replaced by a man just as equal, just as anxious at the time to attack Russia in the form of von Falkenhayn. But I think, yes, unless you have any questions, I can move on to the...
Just a super quick one. Did von Moltke the Younger, did he have some sort of nervous breakdown? Or is that an unfair characterization of what happened with him?
I mean, from what I gather, yes. He did sort of lose, again, a lot of self-confidence. And this was something that he was always often accused of as well. That he went, he was overly cautious on occasion and then went into these rather sort of violent bouts of anger on another. But in terms of, the most famous sort of mental breakdown of a German officer during World War One, that of course has to be reserved to von Ludendorff towards the end of the First World War. Yeah. But yes, yeah. And I think it's understandable given the amount of pressure that Moltke was on, and that understanding, of course, that all his best laid plans had ultimately resulted in failure.
I mean, I couldn't dream of a tiny fraction of that pressure. I absolutely don't blame anyone for cracking. I mean, it's even just talking about it now gives me a bit of a cold sweat, unbelievable. I'm not sure how men.
Well, yes, I
really
mean,
we
can develop von Moltke's, especially his political aspects of him, as this conversation progresses. But this gets us on to the main thing which everyone is waiting for, which is the assassination of Franz Ferdinand.
Sure. Yep.
Yes, if you know nothing else about the causes of World War One, you know about the assassination of Franz Ferdinand. But the likelihood is you don't know how complicated the politics around the assassination of Franz Ferdinand and what the implications were. So just to briefly summarize, Franz Ferdinand was the nephew of the Emperor of Austria-Hungary, Franz Josef. He was the heir to the throne, the Thronfolger. He had been a major figure in terms of military reform, in terms of also plans for reforming the empire, such as, the Popovici plan to create a United States of Greater Austria or to give the Croats some sort of autonomy. He had his own rival court to Schönbrunn, which was the residence of the emperor in the Belvedere, and the circle around Franz Ferdinand was called the Belvedere Circle. So he was a major part of the strategic apparatus of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and he was afforded access to information because of the age of Franz Josef. The expectation was the heir to the throne had to be fully appraised of all matters of national interest in the likely event that Franz Josef would quickly die, and he would quickly have to assume that rank, because of course Austria, the assumption was that even though the emperor often relied on ministers, all sovereignty ultimately was vested in the emperor. And even though there are some assumptions made that Franz Josef was, weak and out of touch, he was still very much in full appraisal and understanding of the events going on, even though he relied increasingly on the advice of his ministers as he aged. So the effect there's also the human tragedy that he was married morganatically, i.e. with someone of unequal rank. He was married to a woman called Sophie Chotek, who was a member of a Bohemian aristocracy. Nevertheless, because he'd married someone who wasn't of the blood royal, he actually had to swear an oath to his uncle, whereby not only would Sophie Chotek not be allowed within any of the royal functions of the House of Habsburg, which was the ruling house of Austria, but that their children would not inherit the throne of Austria-Hungary either, because of this marriage between two unequal parties. So the tragedy of the escapade to Sarajevo on the 28th of June, which is St. Vitus's Day, the national holiday of the Serbs, is that this was one of the few occasions where Sophie Chotek could actually accompany her husband on some sort of function. He deliberately chose the date to almost antagonize the Serbs and their aspirations for taking over that region, more to firm up the position that it was inevitably Austrian territory. And there is an assassination plot hatched by a man called Apis, who was the same man who was behind the assassination of the king of Serbia, the Obrenović dynasty, back in 1903. As a result of this, Apis and the Black Hand represented this weird situation where you had a paramilitary group operating within Serbia, which was operating beyond the bounds of the Ministry of the Interior, albeit there were some links to the official government. But because of the prestige afforded to this group, because they had been responsible in the Serbian Revolution in 1903, they had got their hands dirty when no one else was prepared to and assassinated the previous monarch. They were effectively afforded some form of carte blanche, even though they weren't formally part of the government, which is all the more remarkable that you have this irregular unit associated with the government acting on its own volition. And these are the actors involved in the assassination plot against Franz Ferdinand, albeit the assassins are all domestic Bosnian Serbs linked with Apis. There is a bomb attempt as he's driving through Sarajevo. After the bomb, he then goes and is received at the town hall, where the mayor gives a speech saying it is with great honor that and love that the people of Sarajevo meet you. Of course, not altering his speech after the bomb attack. And Franz Ferdinand berates this man. He leaves the town hall. He takes a turning down a street where he meets another of the assassins, Gavrilo Princip, and the assassin effectively shoots Franz Ferdinand and his wife, Sophie Chotek, mortally wounding both of them. And the last words from Franz Ferdinand to Sophie are, "Stay alive, dear, for the children's sake." And
it's sweet, isn't it? That, I mean, it's not, you know, that's a real human touch, isn't it? That he obviously really cared about her. She wasn't just his trophy consort, someone he was sort of forced to be with, you know. A bit like Nikki and Alex, actually, genuinely, they're like a real married couple that loved each other and really, really desperately cared about their children, you know, like normal modern people. So it's really sad. There's one thing I just want to say about, or ask you really about Franz Ferdinand, is that so he was effectively already sort of acting emperor, would you say? He certainly had a complete power base of his own.
I'd say, yes, power base, not acting emperor.
Okay, that's a bit.
There's quite a big difference. What I would say is that there were many sources of power within Austria-Hungary. One was the Austrian crown, because the empire had two halves. The other was the Hungarian crown. One was the foreign ministry. One was the army. So you have all of these power centers jockeying for interest with the emperor, and the emperor favors some over the others, and their alliances which shift. At this time, you have four people other than the Thronfolger. You have the minister president of Hungary, Tisza. You have the minister president of Austria, Stork. You have the foreign minister, Berchtold, and you have the chief of staff of the royal and imperial forces, Konrad von Hötzendorf. And the effect of the assassination is that Franz Ferdinand had been an advocate for peaceful reform of the empire. He had been in opposition. Ironically, actually, Hötzendorf had been part of the Belvedere Circle and then left the Belvedere Circle to advocate for an increasingly bellicose position, which I outlined briefly on the previous episode against Serbia, a preemptive war against Serbia to prevent the Serbians again forcing a war with Austria to annex various regions, you know, inhabited by Serbs or Slavs, South Slavs in general, within the Austrian Empire. So there is already a breach within the political structure of the empire between Franz Ferdinand and Tisza advocating for peace and reform of the empire. Franz Ferdinand is advocating peace because he believes that any war is going to complicate the already, you know, incredibly fraught domestic situation when it comes to balancing the powers of the nationalities. Tisza doesn't want a war because he believes that any annexations by Austria will weaken Hungary's position within this powder keg, essentially. Whereas Berchtold and Hötzendorf are advocating aggressively for a preemptive strike against Serbia. And the death of Franz Ferdinand means all of a sudden that peace advocate who would have become the emperor and therefore his opinions had to be taken seriously is gone. The Belvedere Circle dissipates and the pro-war party, takes over. In fact, you have a memoranda sent by Hertzendorf, which was shared in the German Foreign Office 2 weeks before the assassination, whereby Hertzendorf had advocated for the complete annihilation of the Serb nation. And what the and what that meant in terms of the practical implications of it, it's very easy to understand that the Austrians wanted to simply annex Serbia. Again, that would have been impossible given the political structure of the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the time, because if they annexed Serbia, it would have meant that the empire had to concede rights to the South Slavs. It would have had to, they would have had to radically shift the nature of what it meant to be Austro-Hungary. Instead, it would have been Austria-Hungary, Yugoslavia attached to it as well, because it would have empowered the South Slavs against the Germans and against the Hungarians. Rather, the chief of staff wanted to destroy Serbian power and allocate certain territories to their new allies, Bulgaria.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.